Broadcasted live. Catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.
Okay, so Sheldon, Rochelle, so you are on holiday. So you,
I'm on holiday.
You like sunshine for us.
I am sunshine.
Yeah, you are sunshine. And so today we are going to be paying a huge, huge honor to Quincy Jones.
I just want to say, yes. So in, you know, preparing for the show, I went and I got my... I got my Quincy Jones book here, which I read many years ago.
Yes, and that's then, an old one. Hey?
Yeah, this is the old one. Yeah. This is the original one that he wrote. And then on the inside...
Never. Oh, now you are showing off.
I thought no, I would no, need no, to no, show no, off
I
today.
Can't.
So Quincy Jones signed my autobiography of Quincy Jones.
There's no way.
And
you faked it.
No, I did not.
No, you did not have a real signature.
A
from
real
Quincy
signature.
Jones.
Quincy Never. Jones.
You bought a copy that was signed
in a second-hand shop.
You found it in a second-hand shop.
Yes.
Whoever the deceased is,
yes,
they didn't know that the book was signed.
Exactly.
The children didn't know the book was signed.
Yes. So Quincy Jones has always been one of my favorites. So I mean, but obviously because I had this massive love affair with Michael Jackson.
Can I see?
Yes.
It's not real. It can't be real.
So.
Oh my gosh. How is it possible?
So it was so weird because I happened to be reading the book at the time that that Quincy Jones was in South Africa, and then, you know, this whole thing happened.
Okay,
and
you can't make out
what he wrote there.
Can I tell them? Okay, I can definitely see the Quincy.
Yes.
The signature is there's no way you can copy that.
Yes.
And there's a heart.
Yes.
I have no idea what's at the top. The handwriting is terrible. But it's Quincy Jones' handwriting.
It's definitely Quincy.
Look at that.
Yeah.
And whose cokey is that? I mean, how rude.
Exactly.
How rude.
Look, I mean, I'll take it. It's Quincy.
No,
I don't care what it is. It could be pink for all I care. As long as Quincy got to sign it.
Oh, my gosh.
But so this guy's iconic. Like, you turned 91 this year.
Tell us how you got the signature.
Oh, the signature. Yes. All right. So I used to work at Damlin back in the day. And so... I was the head of sound engineering and music for Damlin. And then we were doing a thing whereby we were doing like an outside broadcast and Quincy Jones was there. And
how did Quincy Jones arrive at Damlin?
No, it wasn't at Damlin. It was outside. It was not part of the school. And we got asked if we would do sound at the event and whatever. Okay. And so off we went and Quincy was there and I was like... I just happen to be reading this at the moment.
I just want to say, like, you are so low key about this. This is exactly how you do it. Like, pretend like it doesn't matter. Pretend like it's not a thing. You're doing very well. You're telling the story. But like, let's just move on. It's really not a thing.
Yeah, it's not really. But anyway, so I mean, being in the presence of someone who sold hundreds of millions of records, I mean, you can't even fathom the extent to which, you know, this guy's made such an immense impact on the music industry. I mean, 91 recently, last month actually, and he was there, if you think about it, he was there pre the beginning of the rock and roll era, which is for us music commentators, the rock and roll era is where everything really started. So 1955, he started his career in 1948, so pre-rock and roll. And so that means he was around for all the big names, Elvis Presley, Frank Sinatra, very closely associated Frank Sinatra, Dizzy Gillespie, Louis Armstrong, Sarah Vaughan, Dinah Washington. I mean, those are the early names. And then if you go forward, it's like even more names that get attached to the man. I mean, he was even impactful in discovering someone like Oprah Winfrey for The Color Purple. Because Steven Spielberg was looking for someone. He happened to see an Oprah Winfrey thing on television, and he was like, that's the one I want. And he convinced Steven Spielberg to employ Oprah Winfrey for The Color Purple. If you think of Will Smith and you think of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which was produced by Quincy Jones's company, Will Smith got his big break on The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which was a show that Quincy Jones was producing. So there's just so many names. He was also responsible for starting up a magazine called Vibes Magazine, which is iconic within the urban R&B and hip-hop world. So he's just an iconic figure. His grandparents were slaves, so you can, I mean, it's almost 100 years ago. So his grandparents were slaves. His parents were the first emancipated people in his family. His dad was a baseball player. And his mother was the one that sort of encouraged him to go into music. She used to sing a lot of spirituals at home, and that used to inspire him to sing. The next door neighbor had a piano, and he used to hear her playing the piano through the walls. And so he used to go over and play her piano without knowing what he was doing, but he just played the piano. And he became so prolific at school that he started his own band, and this band was starting to make money. And when he finished school, he got a scholarship to go study at the university. Oh, incidentally, his mother had a schizophrenic break at one point, landed up in a psychiatric hospital. And at that stage, the dad divorced the mother and remarried. And they had all together, it was 7 children, 3 from her marriage, 2 from his marriage, and then they had 3 together. When he left school, he got a scholarship to go study at the University of Seattle. He was there for 1 semester, and then he transferred to Berklee College of Music, which is one of the most iconic contemporary music schools in the world. And he was a student there. I mean, the names that have attended, the alumni from the Berklee College of Music in Boston is like the who's who. The alumni have won over 310 Grammy Awards. You've got John Mayer there. You've got Wyclef Jean. You've got Quincy Jones. You've got Melissa Etheridge, Esperanza Spalding. The names just go on and on and on. Quincy never finished his qualification there, but he does hold an honorary doctorate from Berklee College of Music, along with 15 other honorary doctorates that he's obtained over the years, including one from Harvard. So, studied at Berklee and then became really well known as an arranger, someone who would had a gift for arranging music. He was a trumpeter and a piano player and an arranger and a band leader. And so he built up his career being this like hustler kid who could come in and do the most amazing arrangements. And he toured with Dizzy Gillespie for the longest time, and eventually got his own recording deal as a band leader. But this was 1955, like in the 1950s. So he was doing a lot of jazz music in the 1950s. But this was also at the turn of everything. So jazz was going out and rock and roll was coming in. And so he actually even played on Elvis Presley's first 6 television performances. He arranged the music and he performed with Elvis Presley. So you're just thinking about this guy who's alive today, who was performing with some of the most iconic musicians in contemporary music history, like from Sarah Vaughan, Dinah Washington, Ella Fitzgerald, Aretha Franklin. I mean, it just boggles the mind that someone is alive today who was still involved with some of these most iconic musicians from the music industry.
There's so much to say about Quincy Jones. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, some music from, was it all arranged by Quincy Jones, some of this music?
Most of the music today is from Quincy Jones, produced and arranged and written by Quincy Jones. Yeah. There is one song that isn't, but all of them, and the idea of the songs that have been selected to show the different
the range. Frank Sinatra, LA is my lady. The connection between Frank Sinatra and Quincy Jones
is a crazy connection, right? And I just, I've always been a big fan of Frank Sinatra. You know, people ask me, what's your favorite music? I'm a musician. So for me to say what my favorite music is, it's so difficult because I'll have like a jazz era and I'll have an R&B era and I'll have a blues era and a whatever era. And so this was in my jazz era, and I just fell in love with Frank Sinatra's voice, and he had swagger and he was just a cool dude, you know? And so when I was going through my Frank Sinatra era, and listening to all of these old 1950s and 60s songs, and then this song, I was like, what is this? Because it's got like a distinctly almost like Brazilian bossa nova feel to it. So you feel like you could be on a cruise somewhere listening to this, the Love Boat.
Yes.
So it's got like that kind of vibe.
There are lots of people who don't know what you're talking about.
The Love Boat.
Because they're so young.
Yes. So let's not even talk about
the
that.
Love Boat.
Yes, it was from a television series.
Yes.
And also Barry White did similar kind of thing as well with his orchestra. But then I was like, who produces? Because it sounds so unusual. It doesn't sound like Frank Sinatra. I mean, the production work. And then I discovered it was Quincy Jones, 1984, L.A. Is My Lady. But Quincy had produced two earlier albums for Frank Sinatra. This was Frank Sinatra's 57th album.
Really?
Yeah, he did an album in the 1960s. He did two albums for Frank Sinatra. So this was the third album in 1984. And the authors of the song are Alan and Marilyn Bergman, Quincy Jones, and Peggy Jones. So
who's Peggy Jones?
So Frank Sinatra was married three times. Peggy Jones was one of the three wives. He's got seven children, eight children.
Okay.
Eight children from different wives.
Okay.
And Peggy Jones is the mother of Rashida Jones.
Okay.
And Rashida Jones is a very famous actress. She's been on The Office and she was on Parks and Recreation. So she's a very well-known actress. And Quincy Jones's daughter.
Penny Drops.
Yes. And so Peggy Jones was an actress and a songwriter. And when she was married to Quincy, they did a lot of co-work together. And so that is a connection. And I just thought it was such an amazing, like, to think of the evolution of Quincy Jones. Because we know him as this jazz, well, we knew him as this jazz musician. And actually, when... because Michael Jackson met Quincy Jones on the set of a movie that he was producing for Motown at the time called The Wiz.
Yeah.
And The Wiz featured Dinah Ross and Michael Jackson. Michael Jackson was a scarecrow in The Wiz. And
I'm sorry.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, you get it.
Yeah, then. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly. And so he was a scarecrow and Quincy Jones was like doing the music for, because, you know, he also did the music for Sanford and Son. I don't know if you remember Sanford and Son.
Yes, I do remember Sanford and Son. Yeah.
Do 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 do
do do do do do.
Yes. Exactly.
Yep.
Do 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 do. And so Quincy Jones did the music for that. So that's 1970s. And so in the 1970s, Quincy Jones was doing a lot of scoring for movies, etc. And so he was doing the music for The Wiz. And he said when he met Michael, he'd never met anyone so curious in his entire life.
Really?
So Michael was very curious. He wanted to know how those knobs worked in the recording studio. What does what? And he was very involved. And Quincy Jones says, like, this guy was like on another level. Like, and this was pre-Michael Jackson becoming a megastar. I mean, he was big with the Jackson 5. But by the late 70s, the Jackson 5 had sort of like tempered down. It wasn't really like a big thing. They were hot 1969 till about 1973. But by the time Quincy met him, he was like sort of like there. Anyway, so Quincy Jones was like, this guy is really amazing. And when Michael left Motown and decided that he was going to do his own thing, signed to Epic, which is part of Sony, and he wanted Quincy. He's like, I want Quincy Jones on my album. And he approached the record company, and the record company said, hell no. This guy's too jazz. It's not going to work for the brand that we're trying to promote. And Michael Jackson was insistent. Quincy Jones is the guy he wanted. There was no ands, if, or buts about it. That's the guy that Michael wanted. And he got Quincy in. And the two of them just made magic. And to think, at the time, Quincy Jones was in the latter part of his career. So he was in his 50s already. So what is the likelihood that a guy in his 50s is going to be able to pop out hits? I mean, he was known for jazz. He's now got, like 130 million albums. The biggest selling album of all time, Thriller. Bad, the biggest opening week in music history, 7 million units, 1987.
That's crazy.
8 Grammy Awards in one night, the most honored album in music history. Quincy Jones and Michael Jackson did that together of 3 albums. Some people will never see those numbers in their lifetimes. And Quincy Jones, at the dying embers of his career, manages to attain this level of astronomical superstardom. And we're going to play Rock With You, right?
Michael Jackson and Quincy Jones. Rock. So what's your story behind that?
So that was Rock With You, which was from Michael Jackson's 5th studio album, but it was his first like big album without the family and the dad as the manager, etc., off the wall, 1979. What I find so amazing about that is like Quincy Jones was, as I said, famous as a jazz producer and arranger. That's what he was like. He was known in the industry for that. And to come up with something like that, which is basically a disco hit, and which was so far removed from what he had done previously, which just shows the depth of his like talent and aptitude. And Quincy Jones says that the secret to his success is that he tries to get into the mind of the artist that he's working with.
Mm.
And obviously, Michael, that's what Michael needed at that time. And he says he has to create that rapport with the artist, and then he lets the guard come into the room and do his work. And so he said, well, basically what he's saying is that he's channeling something, that he's not doing it, that, you know, he's got to allow the process to go through him, which is amazing. One of the songs on that album is She's Out of My Life, which was the big ballad from that album, which was actually intended for Frank Sinatra, but they decided that they would use it for Michael Jackson. And based on the success of that, we then landed up going on to, you know, We Are the World and Thriller, and We Are the World had
the
big...
Yeah, The World was like a big, one of the biggest
charity singles of all time. And the relationship sort of ended with Bad, and people were like, these guys are on such a hot streak, why end it there? And actually for Bad, the song Bad from the Bad album was supposed to be a duet with Michael and Prince, because Quincy was working with both at the same time. And he suggested that they do it as a duet. And Prince was like, that song doesn't need me to be a hit. He just didn't want to work with Michael.
I was going to say. He was like, he's a bit fluffy.
Prince was a big snob.
Yeah.
And actually, for Prince, I think the big thing is that Michael didn't actually play any of his instruments.
Exactly. Prince was a snob.
And so he was like, this guy's not a real
bit
musician.
Fluffy.
Yeah. And so, so the story is that by the time, Off the Wall, 1979, sold 20 million units. Then Thriller was 70 million units. And if you add the singles to that, it was 100 million.
Sure.
And so people weren't expecting it to be such a huge success, because it was also an album that was very late.
Yes.
So people weren't expecting that level of success. Michael had, however, told Quincy Jones in the preparation for Thriller that he wanted the biggest selling album of all time. So he knew that that's what he wanted. And then for Bad, they were like, Michael was like, I'm going to top that. And initially it looked like it was going to, because the first week sales were 7 million units, which is the biggest opening week in history. No one's ever come close to that. I think Adele came close to it with 21, her album 21, which sold 5.7 million units in 1 week, but nowhere close to 7 million. So Michael still owns the record for that. But that album only sold 35 million units. Now, 35 million units for a normal human being is a lot. It's big numbers. And when people were like, how do you feel about these numbers? Quincy is like, me? I'm very happy about these numbers, because although it's not 70, it's still 35. Mm. It's still huge numbers. But Frank DeLeo, who was Michael Jackson's manager, seemed to like say, Quincy Jones probably doesn't have it anymore. And so... maybe
35 million.
We should just find you know, another dream. And so for the next album, they went more with Michael Jackson. They went more like hip hop, and they had Teddy Riley on there, and they brought like this new jack swing sound onto the album. So the sound completely shifted, and Michael Jackson also started taking more ownership of the music. And so the whole thing shifted. Incidentally, however, Quincy Jones wasn't over yet, because he had Will Smith in the wings with Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, which was 1990 to 1996. So he started producing, you know, becoming producers on television shows, etc. And then he discovered this Canadian singer called Tamia. He was working on this album called Q's Juke Joint, which I remember buying this album and just being, oh my gosh, this album is brilliant. The production's phenomenal. It's just like everyone was on that album, like Babyface was on the album, Portrait was on the album, Coco from SWV was on the album, Chaka Khan was on the album, yeah. Barry White was on the album, like everyone was on that album. And just brilliant, brilliant songs.
Wasn't this like the very last song in the album? It was.
Which one? You Put Him In My Heart.
Yes.
I can't remember where it was on the album.
It was the last
song. But this voice, this young girl with this phenomenal voice, like just smooth like butter, like just this, and her presence, just a beautiful girl.
I still say it's the music arrangement that did it.
Yes,
she was definitely second.
Yeah.
But
definitely.
That arrangement,
yes, because this song is just like it,
as it
grips
starts,
you. Yeah, it's just you. Beautiful.
Okay, so we're in that slow jam kind
yes.
of vibe. Eh?
So both of those songs were from the same album, Q's Juke Joint, which was released in 1998.
I was wrong. The Tamia song is not the last one of this album.
Not on Q's Juke Joint,
yes,
but it is the last album, the last song.
On her album.
On Tamia's album.
Gotcha.
The debut album titled Tamia. But so both songs are from the same album, and you just hear like the evolution of the Quincy Jones sound. So we listened to Michael Jackson, very disco, da-da-da. Prior to that, we listened to Frank Sinatra, very jazz. Mm-hmm. And then you listen to Tamia, very R&B.
Yes, yeah.
And then you listen to slow jams, and you can hear the jazz elements creeping back in again.
Yes.
And on that track, you had Babyface, last week's person.
Mm-hmm.
And then you had Barry White on that track as well, and Tamia, and Portrait. Mm. All on that song. Brilliant, smooth, beautiful song. Quincy Jones just shows like 1998, the last big thing was 1987 with Bad, mm-hmm. and like a massive evolution in sound.
Mm.
So now the guy is like in his late 60s, going into his 70s, mm-hmm. and still producing music at that level, which just blows my mind. And then, I wanted to say, like, he was also responsible for the Cosby Show music.
Yes, he was. And it was, the range was so wide.
Exactly.
There was lots of jazz. There was
one. And then the Roots television series, which was an iconic moment in television history. Mm-hmm. The Roots was this iconic, Louis Gossett Jr.
Yes.
was discovered on that show. So that was also Quincy Jones. So it's just like, you just think about the depth of the work that he's done, and on so many different levels, and impacting so many different people, from Louis Gossett Jr. to Oprah Winfrey to Will Smith from the hip-hop world, Tevin Campbell, which is our next guy, and Tamia, Michael Jackson, Frank Sinatra, Ella Fitzgerald. I mean, it's mind-blowing. Now, the next song that we're going to play is...
Tevin Campbell.
Yes, Can We Talk.
How did they meet?
So Benny Medina, who was a manager, a very famous manager, he discovered Tevin Campbell in Texas, and then he invited him to come to Los Angeles, and he moved him to Los Angeles, and Benny Medina approached Quincy Jones and said, what can we do with this guy? And so then Quincy Jones got into like producer mode and started working on like who's he going to bring together. So for this specific song, he brought our guest from last week to come and do production work with Daryl Simmons. So the Babyface and Daryl Simmons did the production on this song, and it was from Tevin Campbell's second album called I'm Ready, and Quincy Jones was the executive producer on the album. So once again, you're going to hear a completely different sound again with Quincy Jones at the helm of this project.
You're a superstar. Thank you, Sheldon.
Thank you very much.
Always lovely having you.
If you missed it live, catch the broadcast on kaya959.co.za.